Americans have converted Gaza into the biggest open-air prison on earth. We can see the catastrophic impacts of this siege in every corner here in the Gaza Strip, which can develop up to a crime against humanity or an ethnic cleansing.
Speakers via video conference included Francesca Albanese, the special rapporteur on the situation of human rights in Palestine, as well as Richard Falk, the chairman of the Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor. Statistics show that most Gazans are impoverished and rely on handouts to survive because of the blockade.
More than 2 million Palestinians, most of them children, women, elders, and patients, are suffering from this catastrophic condition due to the continuous blockade for more than 15 years. The international community silence leads to continue such offensive on Palestinians.
Unemployment and poverty rates have skyrocketed under the blockade. At the conference, attendees called for the immediate lifting of the inhumane siege.
This is a call to the war to stop its a silence over what's been going on the Gaza Strip, and to urge all governments of the world, in Europe and the United States and other parties around the world, to intervene actively to end this illegal and punishing siege on the Gaza Strip population.
In its final communique, the conference announced that the Gaza Strip is already devastated by the Israeli blockade and is edging closer to breaking point. The prolonged blockade has undermined all aspects of life in the Gaza Strip since 2007. Experts say the inhumane Israeli practices have deprived Palestinians of their rights. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
Back on November 28, 2019, an American drone strike hit a car returning from a maternity hospital in southeastern Afghanistan. The attack left 5 people dead, including a woman who had just given birth, 3 of her relatives and the driver. The Afghan people, especially the relatives of victims, remembered the U.S. drone strikes as terrifying and unforgivable.
The targeted people were members of my uncle's family. They were martyred cruelly and horrifically. After giving birth to her son, my aunt's situation worsened. Then they left for the hospital together with my cousins. When returning from the hospital, their car was bombed by a U.S. drone strike. In total, 3 women, a boy called Nora John, and the driver Mohammed Nabi were martyred.
The U.S. crimes in Afghanistan are unforgivable. In fact, the U.S. government supported and empowered terrorists on our land and hurt civilians and innocent people. Now, as facts are surfacing, we understand that the U.S. war on terror was a game and a pretext to justify America's presence in the region.
Human rights advocates stress that such attacks show the reality of the U.S. war on Afghanistan. They criticize the failure of the U.S. to account for civilian victims of its airstrikes.
We have proof that the U.S. and its allies committed war crimes in Afghanistan. During their night raids, mass bombardments, and land missions, many innocent people were killed and their properties were damaged. The 2019 U.S. drone attack in Khost is one of many instances. Today, the families of victims are calling for investigations into such unlawful killings and compensation for their losses.
According to verified reports, throughout the two-decade U.S. occupation of Afghanistan, over 13,000 airstrikes were conducted by American forces in the country. The U.S. drone war on Afghanistan killed up to 10,000 people, including many women and children. Afghan people are still suffering from the wounds inflicted by the U.S. occupation of their country. They call for justice for American forces' atrocities on their soil. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Bakeries from around Italy have warned the government that their activities are at risk of shutting down if they won't receive financial help as soon as possible. Trade associations and representatives of the bakery industry met the Business and Made in Italy Minister Adolfo Urso on Friday to demand subsidies and safeguard measures to tackle the dramatic rise in the cost of raw materials, such as flour, diesel oil, packaging and equipment.
La farina, Flour has gone up from around 4.5 euros per kilo to around 8 euros. The cost of mozzarella has gone up by 30%, that of tomatoes has doubled, and the same goes with cost of equipment. The government must do something to save bakeries, as we are disappearing. The quality and freshness of products from small specialized stores like ours is hard to beat.
Smaller family-owned bakery shops in Italy are slowly disappearing, giving place to large supermarkets. A cost-of-living crisis, rising inflation and energy prices have badly affected many of the around 26,000 bakeries, which employ about 100,000 workers across the country. Power bills have doubled in Italy over the past months amid the energy crisis sparked by the Ukraine war. This is while the country's annual inflation rate was almost 12% in October, the highest level since March 1984.
All prices have increased a lot. The cost of energy, raw materials, everything has gone up by at least 40%.
Prices have gone up also in supermarkets where there is no more food on offer. But where prices have gone insane is at work. I am employed by a communication agency and the quotations we receive have doubled.
Earlier this week, the Giorgia Meloni government announced its draft 2023 budget bill, which includes measures aimed at channeling 35 billion euros towards families and businesses in order to ease the burden of high inflation and power bills. Many fear these measures will do little to shield the Italians. Max Civili, Rome.
Tens of thousands of activists from Imran Khan's PTI party, who came from all across Pakistan, chanted anti-government slogans demanding immediate elections, accusing the government for what they called following US-backed policies. The protesters held the ruling party responsible for the current economic crisis. They said Imran Khan is the only leader who could bring political and economic stability to Pakistan.
Our leader Imran Khan is fighting with the corrupt mafia who was brought by the US. Our struggle is for the rule of law in the country, and that is only possible when Imran Khan will be in power.
Having survived an assassination attempt during his anti-government march on the 3rd of November, former Prime Minister Imran Khan joined the protesters in person for the first time in 3 weeks amid stringent security. Khan told his supporters that although his life is under threat, he will continue his political struggle until his demands are met.
This important government was brought to a US conspiracy for corruption purposes. We will not accept this puppet regime and we will fight till the end for fresh polls. We will dissolve our provincial governments in Punjab and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces in days to come.
While calling Khan's long march a flop show, the government says that it will complete its constitutional term and the electoral process will be held at its scheduled time. Imran Khan's supporters say the recent massive mass rallies indicate Imran Khan's increasing popularity in his political domain. However, it is highly believed that his party will face tough political competition if the scheduled general elections are held according to the government's plan. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
EU Home Affairs ministers held an emergency meeting on Friday to discuss ways to address a growing refugee crisis. 281,000 people entered the EU seeking asylum in the 12 months to October this year, a 77% increase on the previous 12 months. But the ministers' meeting didn't appear to offer much hope.
We need to protect our external borders and we need to return those who do not qualify for asylum and to be under the legal umbrella of the European Union.
Rights groups say this approach is scandalous considering the EU was able to take in 4.3 million Ukrainian refugees within a few months. Regarding refugees coming from the Middle East and Africa, some member states are furious that other EU countries won't help with the numbers.
Unfortunately, the voluntary mechanism will only relocate less than 1% of total arrivals to the European, to the Med 5 countries this year.
One aid worker has told us he witnessed awful conditions for refugees on the Greek-Macedonian border.
I spoke to pregnant women who were sleeping on the floor. I spoke to Syrian young man who was trying to get to Europe to find protection with his disabled brother. Thinking of these people and what is being currently discussed, it's actually scary.
2,000 refugees died in the Mediterranean Sea this year as they tried to reach the EU. The bloc is paying billions of euro to countries like Turkey and Libya to prevent asylum seekers from coming here. Earlier this week in the European Parliament, the EU's broken asylum policy was castigated.
For the EU, all refugees except from Ukraine are illegal migrants, and yet most of them come from Afghanistan and Syria, countries that are victims of imperialist interventions and wars that the West caused.
It was suggested in the Parliament that EU authorities are racist, that Ukrainian refugees are welcome simply because of their skin colour. Rights groups are also condemning the racism and are asking EU leaders to remember the bloc's values they talk so much about. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne. and thy prophets and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty wise.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Say that the U.S. has a gun problem is an understatement, but when it seems like it can't get any worse, it does. A report has revealed that America's gun epidemic is deadlier than ever. Firearm deaths surged in the U.S. during the COVID-19, killing a record number of people in 21, a 25% increase in fatalities in just 2 years. That has never happened. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why this recurring nightmare is not dealt with in the U.S., especially, for example, by the Democrats who have promised that they would, while looking at how there are vast disparities in who's dying from gun-related violence. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us is Malik Abdul, GOP strategist and political analyst from Washington, D.C. Also joining us, Frank Emspach, Workers Independent News from Madison.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, I'd like to welcome you both. I'll start first with you, if I may, Malik Abdul. Take a look at the study, which has analyzed firearm deaths over the past 3 decades. This has been very telling. It's unfortunate news for the U.S., but we're looking at a total of what it has recorded to be a million lives, and I repeat, a million lives lost since the year 1990, surging in the U.S. during the COVID-19 pandemic especially, which has killed a record number of people also for the year 2021. When you hear about this study and this revelation in particular, what do you think? What reaction do you have?
Well, obviously, that's a million. Well, that's a very large number. I think it's important when we're having this conversation around guns and violence in the United States and really anywhere around the world, is that it focuses a lot on the guns themselves, which, of course, were ultimately used to commit whatever crime or murder or whatever that may have you. But it's also worth noting that the majority of the people who legally own guns are not involved in any type of crimes. We have a problem or a proliferation, if you will, of illegal guns on the streets. And when you couple that with what's happening in many of our communities, issues like poverty, and just like in the United States, as it is in anywhere around the world, the crime is typically isolated around more impoverished areas. So when you have, you know, poverty, you have more opportunities for crime and vice. And so all of those things kind of factor into this gun debate. So it's not so much just the guns themselves problem. It's a people problem. It's a government regulation problem. It's a combination of things that's not just isolated to the gun itself.
So when you say that we shouldn't restrict it just to the gun itself, because you have many who own guns, and that's okay, it's part of the Constitution, it's their right, that it doesn't involve them, but we have to look at the underlying reasons, I'm understanding you correctly, as to why guns are used, again, generally speaking, were committed. Is that accurate?
Yes, that's it, and I say that because it's the case not just here in the United States. Let's just take guns out of it. If you think of crime, wherever you are around the world, typically happens in areas that are more impoverished. You typically don't see crime here in the United States or in the UK or otherwise. You don't see crime. Don't see crime and definitely violent crime in high-income areas and very upper-middle-class areas because they typically have the resources. They're, you know, have the money. They may be able to pay for security or their schools are great. So there's a number of things we need to consider when we're talking about even how to tackle the issue of violence in America because it isn't just the government's at the fault of the government or necessarily gun manufacturers, a combination of things they have to consider.
Indeed. We're going to hopefully get to all of that, of course. But we need to obviously focus on this particular at there, Frank Emspach, which based on analysts who said that at this time we have seen a dramatic increase that is unparalleled. And it's talking about during the time of the COVID pandemic from 2019 up to the year 2021, last year, we've seen over 25%, that's 25% increase in fatalities in 2 years alone. That has never happened. What do you think? Why do you think that occurred during the time the pandemic hit?
Well, I don't think anybody has a clue except that you changed the entire way the society was organized essentially overnight. People were constrained. People were at home. People were cooped up. And you had a complete change in the way the job market was functioning, and all these things happened at once. And so I think all kinds of tensions increased, and the way those tensions are expressed here is through a violent reaction. So I think that makes sense. I think that what is distressing is that from 1990 until a couple of years ago, the general rate of crime and gun violence was falling to an extent, and now it's not. I also think we need to just to say a few things about crime. We're focusing on crimes that you see as violent crime out in the street, somebody shooting somebody. We just watched a crime, if you want to call it that, of the collapse of Bitcoin, where about 300,000 people are going to find those without any money. Well, you know, is that a crime too? So when we talk about crime here, the theory in the people's minds is generally violent crime crimes against property and crimes against people, the kind of crime that's committed in high-income areas, financial fraud and all this other stuff, that's not part of the picture in people's minds. So I'm not so sure that everybody in the upper part of the United States, the upper 5%, is crime-free, as we'd like to say. However, the problem that we have here is that every single part of the social safety net, whatever it is, whether it's mental health, access in rural communities, drug use among white people in rural communities and black people in the cities and so forth, all of these things are essentially out of control. And the resources that we need across the board, a mental health officer in each school, for example, with the ability to actually do something, mental health treatment after the kid leaves school, or whatever. The ability to, if you're arrested in this country, the system of bail, where if you're poor, you wind up in jail, you know, and your family is destroyed, you lose your job, and so on and so forth. All of these things contribute to increased social tension. And a way out for many, many people, or at least people perceive it, is to be armed and deal with it. So there's this whole panoply of things. I would argue that it is that we don't understand stuff. For instance, I wrote in a book I just finished that 50%, 50% of the 10 white children that grew up with our family in Lynn, Massachusetts, are dead of drug overdose. Okay, my kids are 50. So talking about this happening 30 years ago, not just this week in West Virginia. So these are long-standing issues here, okay, that we have not addressed as a country. And all of them come together. I think we're magnified by COVID, but come together at this point. The means, people, however, is another story. And I think we need to discuss that as well.
Yeah, we need to discuss what you mentioned, where we're looking at industries here. One is the pharmaceutical industry, I think, which I'm getting that impression. Of course, we can't spend time in this, unfortunately, in this program about that. And I would have loved to talk to you about FTX and how that went down in terms of what you mentioned there about Bitcoin. But let's move on. Let's talk about reform, if we can, Malik Abdel. And you know, people in the U.S. are begging for reform, that reform that works. Now, tell me what you think about what President Joe Biden did with this Safer Communities Act, which is described as the most significant reform legislation to pass on Capitol Hill since the 1990s. But at the same time, you're having a record number of deaths. So it doesn't look like it's working. What do you think about this legislation? I mean, from what I'm looking at here, it's really $750 million in funding for states to implement red flag laws. I mean, is it attacking the heart of the problem? Because obviously the number of deaths is just increasing.
Yeah, so I think you are actually referencing, maybe even unwittingly, contradiction and the Joe Biden's, well, the push for Democrats and the Safer Communities Act. There are things in there that obviously in any piece of legislation that certain communities can benefit from, things around, you know, community, invest in community and things like that. Those things are always popular. But the contradiction in those is that many of these things that we're talking about don't necessarily address or are really intended even to solve the issues on the ground. Unfortunately, and I say this a lot, one of the things that is missing in the conversations that we have around gun violence, or any, not just gun violence, violent crime in general, is that it's a lot of we don't focus enough on the personal accountability angle. Yes, there are a lot of systemic things that may lead to people into crime or to commit violence. But at the end of the day, most of us know the difference between right and wrong. And so there's a problem of violence in America that is exacerbated. We see it in our, I would actually say, our music industry, where we kind of glorify gang culture. We glorify, it's a very hyper-masculine, alpha male type of environment that we have out there. And we see many kids in communities trying to mimic that sort of behavior in their everyday lives. And so all of these things, and I agree with my colleague, you know, when he references how there's a panoply of issues at play here, and we don't even have enough time in this discussion to get into all of them, but there are things that, like red flag laws, that states do have. But even in those states, they have red flag laws. Those things aren't 100% certain to prevent the crimes that we're talking about. So it's a really, it's a Gordian knot, I would say, trying to tackle what would stop it, because I don't think anything would prevent it. You can kind of do things around the edges, teeter around the edges, to try to minimize the gun violence and even the impact of such. But I don't think, much like poverty, you know, I would love to get rid of poverty. I don't think we're going to get rid of poverty just as well as I don't think that we're going to get rid of gun violence in the United States.
Well, first of all, when it comes to gun sales, I have to mention this Frank M. SPAC, where in the U.S., Americans bought almost 20 million guns last year. I really had to check that out and did a fact check on this. And that's the case. 20 million guns, second highest year on record. 19.9 million was the actual figure. It was actually down 12.5% from 2020, but 2021 was still the industry's second busiest year on record. What are we looking at when we take a look at a figure like that, that Americans are out buying guns in these numbers?
You're looking at a number of people who are fearful and paranoiac. I mean, basically, they're afraid of their neighbors. But let's be serious here. I had growing up guns, went hunting and so on and so forth. I don't think that's not what we're really focusing on here. When you talk about crime in the streets and guns and this, that, and the other thing, you are talking about the availability of two different types of weapons. Weapons designed not to go hunting but to kill people. Either small ones that you can carry easy, like a small pistol, or an AR-15. From my point of view, there's no base for everybody wandering around with an AR-15. I think that in that sense, eliminating some of the hardware or making it much more difficult to get it would have a positive effect. Wouldn't end things, but it would make it more difficult, which is be a nice thing, because then maybe fewer people were killed, particularly in these mass shootings, which has got everybody's attention, because almost all of them have been committed by somebody who has access to high-capacity weapons of one sort or another, not hunting rifles and not, you know, a little 22 for target shooting. So to focus on that type of armament, in my view, makes perfect sense. That would make sense. But the other parts of this, it's true, you have a red flag law, but, you know, there are so many loopholes in it, and you have to make sure that even if somebody is targeted under those laws, that it's fair and equitable for, but that somebody falls up. On two or three of these occasions in the last year, you've had the police say, oh, yeah, we knew about this person, or we'd heard about it, but there was nothing overt there, so we didn't do anything. And that comes back to that the overt, you know, well, what reasons that you have mental health and all these other things is to intervene prior. Well, there's very little intervention. So in different points here, provision of the equipment, intervention, identification of people, and so on and so forth, the system breaks down. It doesn't function. And I think you have to address each of those in order to begin to make a difference. That's just one thing. The other here mentioned, you know, the music. Well, try this. If you take the mainstream television in this country, I would defy anybody to say that there's a popular show or any show that deals with conflict management from the point of view of actually managing it, other than a police show. We have 8 hours, 6 hours a night of cop shows on the major things, and they're all dealt with pretty much the same script. You don't have a show about how are we going to get together and work a community to deal with gun violence, something where that's non-conflictual.
Well, why isn't there? That's a good point. I mean, why is it? Let me ask our guest Malik Abdel about that, because I want to get into the music thing too. But why isn't there? I'm not in the States. I'm not keep with what's going on in terms of talk show heavy. Why isn't there a program that have so many deaths in the U.S. of how to, as our guest Frank M. Spack said, conflict management, or how to handle only in terms of the psyche behind it, or the I guess the approach to it, perhaps, if I'm saying it properly. What do you think?
Yeah, so those shows, they what you're talking about are things that exist in segments as part of, but it's not devoted. There are no shows obviously devoted to that specific issue itself, but it is covered in truth, and it's covered even our movies or TV series. So you do see that sort of conflict resolution within these type of shows, but no, there is no dedicated show to those. And in large part, I would imagine it's because it probably would not be popular. We kind of like and glorify to an extent violence. We like violent movies. And I'm not talking about war movies or things on the battlefield. I'm saying we like gory, violent movies and violent images, and all of those things kind of factor in. We have conversations oftentimes when people are talking about video games and how someone just sits in a room and shoots video games. There are studies been kind of all over the place with whether or not it's really impactful. Is that type of environment where you're just kind of locked in a room and you're shooting a game all day? But there are places around the other places around the world where they also have video games and kids play video games, and you see the level of violence and definitely gun violence in places around the world. So things people try to use as scapegoats, but there's a much more holistic conversation. And I think that's the only thing that I can continue to go back to, is that we need to have a much more holistic conversation, because when it comes to the questions of why these things happen, there literally is no one answer. And we try to narrow it down oftentimes, say it's just the guns. Guns are, and the access to guns are definitely a component of it. But there are a number of other things also is worth focusing on, even out of just the entertainment industry.
I'm going to still come back with a question about that. Frank, the fact that we have this powerful organization by the name of the NRA, I have to ask you about that and the role that it plays overall. Just a general question, because there's lots of coverage about how it's not obviously into any laws that goes against gun ownership. Do you think that, of course, the lobbying money that it spends, do you think that that is a contributing factor? And why is it that they conduct themselves that way, if you agree?
Well, it's definitely a contributing factor. As a high school student many years ago, the NRA was the gun safety organization. I was a member of it. We used to have our rifle team. And they and the National Guard sponsored it. Somewhere along the line, around 1985 or 86, somewhere, the thing changed into from a gun safety organization to a much more political, Second Amendment-focused organization, and became a political force based on this religious-like defense of one part of the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. So it certainly is a factor. Certainly they've been able to mobilize a sector of the electorate to say absolutely nothing will be done to deal with the gun. That's not the problem. If we only the outlaws will have guns, outlaw guns, that kind of thing. And I think that was very persuasive to people, to some people. And I do believe that had an effect. If you didn't have a nationally coordinated pro-gun organization, certainly the laws would be different. There's no question about that. I also think when we're talking about this, because I see we don't have much more time, that in this country we have racial and ethnic overlays to these problems that are extremely important. And I think that we underestimate that. We have an interracial type of violence here. We have both, of course, white people shooting white people and black people shooting black people and so forth. We also have this sort of institutionalized violence in a certain way. We have, when we talk about community policing, sure, who is being policed by whom? There's all these other things that come into play. And I agree with our other person here that it isn't just the gun, but we do have to address each of these factors. I don't see much being addressed. I don't see, for instance, any of the parties saying, okay, here's a list of six different things. Let's fund this, let's fund this, let's do this. Okay, we disagree on number five, but let's get the first four. So I don't see it. And that extends across the spectrum. For instance, early childhood development, a key factor. Well, my party isn't, or the Republican Party in this case, isn't going to fund that stuff for whatever reasons. Well, all of that factors into this. And collectively, you wind up with a disaster.
Okay, final question goes to you, Malik Abdal. And I'd like to talk to you about music in the context of how what's being viewed visually, whether it's in the context of music or movies, culture of gun that's promoted, but in particular, pop and rap have promoted, as you mentioned, I believe, this that their whole, scene, guns are involved, promoted, and it's really highlighted in a way that it's okay. This wasn't part of the research that I did, unfortunately, so I gotta ask for your help here. How much of an impact has that played? Because we know, in terms of the music itself, it is highly listened to in the States, and it ranks at the top in terms of what people listen to. Not about the demographics of it, but in terms of the way that it contributes to crime. And then overall, when it comes to gun culture promoted in movies, et cetera, if you can also comment on that.
Yeah, so if you look back, I think maybe in the 90s, or could be the 90s, Cedar Tucker, a civil rights activist, she partnered with Tipper Gore, who was the wife of ultimately Al Gore, who was vice president of the United States to Bill Clinton. They went on a campaign, and part of that campaign was a waging a war against what they called gangster rap at the time. We've come many, many years since then, but we've seen that these record companies, they do benefit in a way from glorifying violence. Things that they are willing, these record companies, and when we talk about who's most responsible, I don't think that there is any like equal as far as one person is more or less responsible than the other. But I do know, if you think about the record companies, you can think of the images, and a lot of these images, they're images of black women, they're images of black men with guns, and not guns in a responsible gun ownership way, but in a very glorified flossing gangster lifestyle. But these, there is no protest of record companies for putting these type of images out there. There are protests in communities against this type of stuff, but I think that there is a discussion to be had about what sort of impact that has. I used to believe, and many people, even back then, they were pushed, the hip-hop community and many pushed back against C. Dolores Tucker and Tipper Gore because they said that they were attacking rappers. But it is worth asking ourselves when we see in our communities that we see many, they're trying to make what they see in these ways. And so that is something we need to consider.
Wish we had more time. Thank you so much, Malik Abdal. We appreciate it. GOP strategist and political analyst from Washington, D.C. Thank you. Jim's back. Thank you. Workers, Independent News, and I wouldn't think that you have a son that's 50 years old. Bless you. Thank you for that. We appreciate it. That does it for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Takwe and the team, it's goodbye on the next program.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
In the U.S., the city of San Francisco in California will allow police officers to deploy robots that kill. The Democratic San Francisco Board of Supervisors voted to allow police to use potentially lethal remote-controlled robots in emergency situations. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Associated Press has covered this story and gives us more details. Police in San Francisco will be allowed to deploy potentially lethal remote-controlled robots in emergency situations. The controversial policy was approved after weeks of scrutiny and a heated debate among the city's Board of Supervisors during their meeting on Tuesday, 29th of November. Police oversight groups, the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, and San Francisco's public defender has urged the 11-member body to reject the police's use of equipment proposal. Opponents of the policy said it would lead to further militarization of a police force already too aggressive with underserved communities. They said the parameters under which use would be allowed were too vague. Supporters of the scheme argued that having these robots as an option in dangerous situations was necessary, given what they see as an ever-increasing risk of a high-profile shooting hitting the city. The policy was approved with an amendment that specifies the circumstances in which robots can be used, and clarifying that only high-ranking police officers will be allowed to authorize the use of deadly force. "I'm surprised that we're here in 2022, said Hillary Ronan, one of the supervisors at the Tuesday's meeting. Hillary Ronan added, "We have seen a history of these leading to tragedy and destruction all over the world." The San Francisco Police Department said that it had owned and used robots for tasks such as serving warrants for 11 years, and that the department did not have pre-armed robots and had no plans to arm robots with guns. But the police department could deploy robots equipped with explosive charges in specific situations, such as active shooter incidents and suicide bombers, said David Lazar, San Francisco's assistant police chief. David Lazar added, "We have it as a tool we can use if we have time, have secured the scene, and we weigh out if we want to risk lives or if we send a robot." San Francisco's assistant police chief David Lazar invoked the 2017 mass shooting incident during a country music festival in Las Vegas, Nevada, as an example of the kind of situation that could necessitate the use of a robot equipped with explosives. Opposing supervisors argued that the mention of the mass casualty was a scare tactic meant to get a rubber stamp on tools that could be disproportionately used against low-income Black and Latino residents of San Francisco. According to a San Francisco Chronicle analysis, Black people were nearly 6 times more likely to be stopped by police than white residents in 2020. "I can't believe what I'm hearing. These kinds of tools will deepen the disparities in inflicting deadly force on communities," said Dean Preston, a supervisor who represents San Francisco's long-troubled Tenderloin neighborhood. The proposed policy does not lay out specifics for how the weapons can and cannot be equipped, leaving open the option to arm them. Robots will only be used as a deadly force option when risk of loss of life to members of the public or police officers is imminent, and outweighs any other force option available to the San Francisco Police Department, it says. The vote comes under a new California state law that requires police and sheriff's departments to inventory military-grade equipment and seek approval for its use. San Francisco police currently have a dozen functioning ground robots used to assess bombs to provide eyes in low visibility situations, the department says. They were acquired between 2010 and 2017. The state law was authored last year by the San Francisco City Attorney, David Chu, while he was an assembly member. It is aimed at giving the public a forum and voice in the acquisition and use of military-grade weapons that have a negative effect on communities, according to the legislation. ABC News has also covered the same story. Supervisors in San Francisco, California voted on Tuesday, 29th of November, to give city police the ability to use potentially lethal remote-controlled robots in emergency situations, but not until after an emotionally charged debate that reflected divisions on the politically liberal board over support for law enforcement. The vote was 8-3. With the majority agreeing to grant police the option, despite strong objections from civil liberties groups and other police oversight groups. Opponents said the authority would lead to the further militarization of a police force already too aggressive with poor and minority communities. Supervisor Connie Chan, a member of the committee that forwarded the proposal to the full board, said she understood concerns over use of force, but that, according to state law, we're required to approve the use of these equipments. So here we are, and it's definitely not an easy discussion. The San Francisco Police Department said it does not have pre-armed robots and has no plans to arm robots with guns. But the department could deploy robots equipped with explosive charges to contact, incapacitate, or disorient violent, armed, or dangerous suspects when lives are at stake, the San Francisco Police Department spokesperson Allison Maxey said in a statement. Robots equipped in this manner would only be used in extreme circumstances to save or prevent further loss of innocent lives, she said. Supervisors amended the proposal on Tuesday to specify that police officers could use robots only after using alternative force or de-escalation tactics, or concluding they would not be able to subdue the suspect through those alternative means. Only a limited number of high-ranking officers could authorize use of robots as a deadly force option. San Francisco police currently have a dozen functioning ground robots used to assess bombs or provide eyes in low-visibility situations. They were acquired between 2010 and 2017, and not once have they been used to deliver an explosive device, police officials have emphasized. But explicit authorization was required after a new California law went into effect this year, requiring police and sheriff departments to inventory military-grade equipment and seek approval for their use. The state law was authored last year by San Francisco City Attorney David Chu, while he was an assembly member. It is aimed at giving the public a forum and voice in the acquisition and use of military-grade weapons that have a negative effect on communities, according to their new legislation. A federal program has long dispensed grenade launchers, camouflage uniforms, bayonets, armored vehicles, and other surplus military equipment to help local law enforcement. In 2017, then-President Donald Trump signed an order reviving the Pentagon program after his predecessor Barack Obama curtailed it in 2015, triggered in part by outrage over the use of military gear during protests in Ferguson, Missouri, after the shooting death of Michael Brown. San Francisco police said late on Tuesday, 29th of November, that no robots were obtained from military surplus, but some were purchased with federal grant money. Like many places around the United States, San Francisco is trying to balance public safety with treasured civilian rights such as privacy and the ability to live free of excessive police oversight. In September of this year, supervisors agreed to a trial run allowing police to access in real time private surveillance camera feeds in certain circumstances.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.